Good morning. Welcome, everybody. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all who celebrate. We are going to I'm convening the House Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for this Friday, March 17th. And our first item of business is to approve the minutes of the March 16th meeting. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I do, I would like to say that I really do enjoy the commute to this room better than to the Capitol. So. But I will move.
On record now twice.
So I will move March 16th minutes, please.
The minutes are moved. Is there a discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So our first bill is House File 2183, and I want to first thank Representative Elkins for carrying this bill, as he has done, I think, a couple of biennia. And it is a large and complicated bill, and so we'll go through it and hear some public testimony and then proceed with questions. I'm going to move that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus finance bill, and I'll have some comments later once we hear the testimony. But I want to get right to it, and welcome to the committee, Representative Elkins, again with a big thank you for your work on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. So when my freshman year, Senator Jasinski and I were both as freshmen assigned to take on this issue. I actually, the issue has been around long enough that I think Representative Lee Petersburg has actually had previous versions of this bill as well, if I'm not mistaken, and he's a co-author of the bill this year, and we also have bipartisan authorship in the Senate with both Senator Dibble and Senator Jasinski being the authors of the bill this year. So in 2021, we commissioned an independent expert review study that was done by Rick King, head of the Technology Advisory Committee now is what it's called, and as some of his colleagues prevent. And I spent some time rereading it tonight to refresh myself as to the recommendations and the findings. So the basic problem we're looking at addressing is that, over the last couple of years with our migration from the old failed MNLAR system to the new successful MnDrive system, the advent of Real ID, which added some significant additional requirements for people to get Real ID driver's licenses, the way we process registration and driver's licenses has actually changed quite a bit, but the fee structures and the allocation of revenue has not really changed to keep up with those changes. So when we implemented MnDrive, for example, we made a conscious decision that we were going to shift more of the workload from the back office to the front office. One of the problems in MnLARS is that the front offices, mostly the deputy registrar's offices, which are both combination of both public and private, didn't have the ability to make corrections to records at the front desk, and so applications for whatever driver's licenses or vehicle registration would be completed and sent off to DVS for review. With the new system, instead of putting all of that work of double checking everything in the back office, the new system were much more reliant on giving the deputy registrars at the front office the ability to make sure that those applications are correct at the time of entry while the customer is still standing in front of them. And so we've relieved a lot of the burden in the back office, shifted a lot of the workload to the front office, and then the advent of Real ID just further shifted that workload, because in order to get a Real ID, there are significant documentation requirements that are imposed by the federal government. You have to bring the specific documents that you can bring to qualify for Real ID are very specific. And especially when Real ID was first implemented back in the MNLARS era, frequently seeing cases where, customers would come to the front desk with what they thought were complying documents and turned out not to be, and people were having to come to the front office multiple times to get it done. The transactions were extremely time-consuming, and the DR offices were we're really strained. So I'll just give you my personal example. My wife and I went to apply for our real IDs in early 2020, I guess, just before COVID hit. And my wife brought her Macy's bill as an ID. It had her name and address on it, but it was not acceptable because she'd already torn off the payment stub and mailed it in with the check. And in order to use the document, it had to be completely intact. But we went to the office that existed then in Bloomington, and the woman helping us behind the counter said, "Not a problem. I'll call my friend Julie in the utility department, and she'll fax me over a copy of your utility bill, which is an acceptable form, which will be complete." And so we were able to get our real IDs processed on the first day that we arrived, but the transaction took 15 or 20 minutes. So in this bill, we're doing a bunch of related things to reflect all of this. So first of all, to give DVS and ourselves more flexibility in the funding, we're going to combine the two DVS fees into one. Representative Peterberg brought forward a standalone bill that we heard earlier in the session that would do that. We'll also do that as part of this bill as well. DVS has had problems with having money in their funds, but not necessarily in the right fund that they needed for a particular expenditure, or not having the appropriations from us that they needed in order to spend the money to, for example, hire back office staff. So I think we're going to take care of that. We're going to increase some of the fees to generate some additional revenue. And we're going to view the whole ecosystem here, DVS and the deputy registrars, as one ecosystem. And because one of the other big things that happened during COVID is many more of the transactions went from the front office to online, which is something that we want to encourage. It's more efficient, but a lot more of the revenue was going straight into DVS. A lot less of the revenue was going to the deputy registrars, and so were being stressed. And we've actually lost a lot of deputy registrar offices. Many of the public deputy registrar offices are suffering large deficits. I reached out to officials in Hennepin County, for example, and learned that on an annual basis, they're putting about $2.5 to $3 million a year of property tax money into supporting their driver and vehicle services offices. The office that I had gone to in Bloomington closed because it was suffering about a $300,000 a year annual deficit. And other counties are realizing proportionate losses as well that they're having to subsidize with property tax money as well. So I think we've got the House Research. A summary in here for you of the details. I don't want to walk through all of the really gory details. I'd rather just open things up for questions, because we've been hearing these bills for well over 4 years now.
Thank you very much, Representative Elkins. And when you referenced that you were a first year member, so that certainly dates back to 2019, 2020 biennium. So. Thank you for that. Do any members have questions of the author?
Later.
Okay, we'll save those for later. Mm-hmm. Why don't we just get right into the testimony? So first on our list is Hong Zhang from DVS.
Assistant Commissioner Zhang is not present today, but Megan is going to be.
Okay, great. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Megan Gallagher. I'm the legislative analyst at Driver and Vehicle Services Division. Mr. Zhang wants to apologize for not being able to be here today, but I am certainly here to provide some information for the committee. There are several sections of this bill that DVS can absolutely administer as drafted, and then there are some requirements in this bill that we actually already have in place at DVS. That includes things like the real-time exam appointment availability and the use of the online pre-application process for credential applications. However, there are some parts of the bill that DVS has concerns with that could have potential unintended consequences, and we certainly look forward to working with the author and stakeholders and authors at the Senate to make sure that we end up with a bill that can be administered by DVS. Thank you.
Great. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain or at least give us a brief description of those areas that you do have problems with?
So I don't, Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, I don't have a full list with me today, but one example would be in Section 13 on page 9. There's a requirement there that every single person who enters the MnDrive system to look at a record and doesn't complete a transaction would need to make a note in the system. Mm-hmm. Currently, all deputy registrars and our e-services for business partners have that option to leave the note, but if we require it for every person, that would mean every law enforcement officer who enters the system, and they hit the database thousands of times per day to retrieve data, would need to leave a note. Any DVS employee who's going into the system to do their part of their regular duties but isn't completing transactions would need to leave a note every time. And that also adds some concerns for the MnDrive programming team in terms of how much data they would then need to store. And when they go in to actually make updates to the system and make the data accurate, they would need to leave notes every time they do that as well.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Are there other questions of DVS?
Can I? Mr. Chair, on this issue, I mean, this stems from a general concern about kind of unauthorized access to the system, a deep privacy concern. I suspect that there are other much easier ways to address this issue.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, thank you for pointing that out. Yes, currently there is the capacity in MnDrive. It already creates an audit trail, and we're able to see what people have accessed. Creating the note gives them the option to explain why they were there so that if there is an audit and they get asked about it, it's easier to explain and understand what happened. But requiring it is a whole different thing altogether. Thank you.
Thank you. So I have a question then. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of, in Section 17, there are a lot of requests of the department. And I think some of these are seem to make a lot of sense. Others, I'm not so sure about. Do you have the capacity to do this? Some direction on what you think would be priorities within this list and things that you think, may not be needed or necessary. When I read the bill, I was just, reminded how much is in this report. And so I wanted to get your comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, DVS would be happy to provide kind of what we think the priorities in that report would be. And we are looking into how many hours we think that it might take to draft something like this and the kind of expertise that it might require. I don't have, a priority list for you today, but certainly we would agree that there are parts of that report that maybe are less helpful than others. And we'd certainly be able to continue to work with the authors and the chair to get a report that would be really useful to you.
And then one final question for the department. So I know the data sharing issue has been one that, there's been some disagreement between you and the deputies on. Do you feel that there is some kind of a compromise or ways to address some of their concerns, but at the same time addressing, I think, your financial, I think this becomes a financial issue for the department. Is there a way to kind of, is there a possibility to balance these things, which, seem to have been at least presented over the years as mutually exclusive?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you mean the fee sharing?
The fee sharing, sorry. I said data. Sorry about that. Fee sharing.
Certainly.
The data sharing we don't want. Fee sharing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely, DVS is willing to continue to work and discuss potential solutions to the revenue concerns that have been brought forward by the deputy registrars. We certainly continue to take the position that our deputies are a really important partner in the work that we do in providing this state service, and that the filing fees are what should be their source of income, and that that's really where our focus has been. But we're absolutely willing to continue to work to find a compromise and something that works for both sides, knowing that we really believe that they should be paid for the work that they do through those filing fees.
Thank you. I mean, I would certainly encourage that. And I understand there are some different filing fee proposals kind of floating around, and we hope that they will be ready and available for us to consider when this bill comes back. Representative Elkins, I think you wanted to comment.
Yeah, I think it's essential that we're providing adequate funds for both the front office and the back office, and that we need to end up with a solution where DVS's fund balances are adequate.
Good. Well, thank you very much for your testimony, and pleased to hear that the conversation continues. Okay, next we have Jim Hurst, who is here representing the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association, which represents the vast majority of the current 168 deputy offices across the state. And I'm also here to relay similar concerns on behalf of the Deputy Registrar Business Owners Association, which is a group of deputy registrars who are primarily of the private business owners that are also part of the network of deputy registrars. First, I'd like to thank Representative Elkins for his tireless efforts, as you know, 4 years now trying to advance and enact legislation that would address the concerns of the deputy registrars. I thought his overview was very succinct and very, very well demonstrated and documented the issues that are before the deputies currently. And this has only been enhanced by the switch from MinLARS to MinDrive, the additional workloads that have been put onto us, and quite frankly, stagnant filing fees over the last 10 years. The filing fees are the only thing that generate any type of income for these offices, and that must cover all of their costs, from labor to equipment and everything in between. We view 2183 as a very good framework based on last year's conference committee agreement that unfortunately stalled out at the end of session. And this is a good starting point to finally conclude and hopefully get us on the right footing going forward. And we look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, committee members, and especially the author, to make sure that the final product this year will certainly satisfy and take care of our needs going forward. And with that, I will conclude my remarks and certainly welcome any questions.
President Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hurst, you know, in this bill, I think there's still some question or clarity on the difference between a full service provider, those that are both a deputy registrar as well as a driver's license agent. Are there any out there that are still just a deputy registrar and not a driver's license, and how would this bill impact them?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Petersburg. Thank you for bringing that question forward. Currently, every office is a deputy registrar and has an identifying number with the department that identifies them by number as to being a deputy registrar. In addition to that, every office also has what is called a driver's license agent number. Now, a deputy registrar office does all of the motor vehicle work, such as your tabs and titles. A driver's license agent is required to do the driver's license transactions. However, within the driver's licensed agents, you have either a full or limited agent. And the difference there is a full agent does everything from renewals to if you lose your card during the middle of a cycle, you can come in and, and request a replacement, whereas the limiteds can only do replacement cards during the current cycle. And the reason for that is because the state supplies the camera and the eye exam equipment for the full service offices. And historically, the department viewed that it was not necessary for every office to be a full office, full license agent office, because if they were in close proximity to an existing state exam office, for example, there was really no need to have that equipment cost that the state would bear for supplying it to these offices. Furthermore, if there was another existing full service deputy, driver's license agent in close proximity to that office, there is no need to have that equipment cost borne on each individual office. Where it comes into play with this bill, and especially the King report, is it is encouraging all offices to become a full service provider, meaning they would be a full service driver's license agent. And while that is certainly admirable for customer service across the state, a number of offices, roughly 50 of them, are limited agents. And while the legislation also proposes covering the cost for providing the camera and eye exam equipment, for example, there's also other considerations that offices in this situation would have to cover on their own, such as building out to accommodate the space, training staff to be able to do this type of service, which of course is a cost. And if it is tied to sharing any type of revenue with the state, some offices are going to be put in a very hard position to have to make outlays of perhaps $50,000 so that they could participate in a pool where they would maybe get back $10,000. And I'm just pulling those numbers out as examples. But those are some clarifications that need to be done with this legislation so that we are mindful of this type of situation and perhaps grant exemptions in these cases.
Mr. Chair, may
Representative Petersburg.
Just to clarify, because the question that I really wanted to get to was under this bill, the determination or the definition of full service provider is one who is appointed by the commissioner as both deputy register and driver's license agent. It sounds like you said that they are. Whether or not they actually use it or not is another thing for consequence, but technically they do have a number for both the deputy register as a driver's license agent. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Petersburg, that is correct. However, we want to make sure that there's clarification and that in the end there isn't any confusion where the limited driver's license agents would not be able to participate. So we just want to be careful on that aspect.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Are there any other questions? Representative Elkin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to, you know, add to that, in the King report, you know, one of the reasons why they were recommending the that the additional cross subsidy be limited to full services is because it's where we really need the capacity is in the processing of things like real IDs that only the full service operators perform. The authors of the report didn't feel that that there would be an incentive for limited services offices to become full service offices if that financial incentive wasn't provided.
Okay, thank you, Representative Elkins. Our next testifier is Julie Hansen, and she's here on behalf of Scott County and the Minnesota Association of County Officers.
Let's see again.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Hansen. I am the property and customer service manager for Scott County. One of the hats I wear is deputy registrar, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Scott County, the Minnesota Association of County Officers, and also MICA, the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I want to thank Representative Elkins for bringing this bill forward, Chair Hornstein and Representative Elkins both for your continued support. We've been here at the legislature for years now asking for relief. As Representative Elkins mentioned previously, public entities across the state are having to pass along the financial responsibility of operating their deputy offices to their tax levies and ultimately their individual taxpayers. Our organizations remain committed to a solution that makes us whole and look forward to working with the author, the chair, and your counterparts in the Senate to get this across the line. Thank you, and I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Any questions for Ms. Hansen? Okay. Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify that's not on our list? Okay. Members, any discussion, any questions? Again, we're laying the bill over. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think overall, I think this goes a long ways to getting us where we're at, and I've been in conversation with Representative Elkins earlier as we put it together and kind of continued on with before and with some of the senators as well. And Mr. Burst just came to me and shared with me his view, and I agree with him that a full service provider are, even though you may have the deputy register number and the driver's license agent, it goes on to say under chapter 171, who provides all driver services are included as full service provider, which when you add that into it, that does make some changes into the fee collections. And so I would then indicate that according to the language, then that 50 cents that gets moved back and forth, it would not apply to them, so they would be able to keep that according to this, because they aren't a full service provider, and it specifically says only full service providers need to send that 50 cents off. So there's some few things that maybe we still need to work out. None of them are large. I mean, they're all things that can be done, but that's another area that needs to be done. But I think this is a great start. I appreciate moving it forward. And the department has some issues that sounds like are minimal as well, but we're running out of time, so we need to work on them. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. And let me just make a couple of comments. I agree with you on your many of your statements, and I think I've identified sort of five areas that I think we could work on here before next week. One is, again, as I had mentioned, getting some kind of a compromise arrangement on the fee sharing. I think there's elements of the reporting requirements that I would be interested in that need to be prioritized. I think the question you asked, Representative Petersburg, about full service providers, is a good one, and I think needs to be addressed. And then, I've heard different ideas around fees. And the governor certainly has some ideas in his bill, and I think we'll take a look at that. I think, in fact, we'll kind of probably mix and match ideas from the governor's recs and this one. And then there's a very important one that I really want to provide some specific direction on. On page 11, lines 25 through 31, there's discussion about driver exam stations. Mm-hmm. And I... on this one, I'm going to be very clear that I side with the governor's recs on this. In the budget presentation that they gave us, there was a directive to keep open all 93 stations and to be very, specific about that, whereas I think this language is a little less specific, and so I would, it would be my preference and advice to change 25 to 31, and we'll probably use the governor's language for that one. So those are the kind of five issues, I think, that we've identified through this hearing, which has been very helpful to take a look at, and look forward to more discussion on this when we discuss our overall omnibus bill. And with that, members, do you have any final comments, Representative Elkins?
Just really briefly, I mean, the bill as introduced reflects the agreement that had been reached between the House and the Senate at the end of the session last year. So the Senate has already started tinkering. We have ongoing informal discussions that will continue, but I think we're close enough that that we're going to be able to work this out.
I'm very confident of that as well. Yeah. And again, a lot of appreciation for your a lot of hard work on this. And with that, members, we are laying over House File 2183. Okay, we have one additional bill on our agenda today, and I'm excited that we'll be hearing House File 2677. And this is also a motion to lay over.
We have to go to state and local gov.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. We will be voting on this bill and moving it out of committee. The motion is that House File 2677 be recommended to be referred to state and local government. Okay. To the bill, I think we have an author's amendment here, and so maybe I'll move the DE1.
Thank you very much.
And explain the DE1, and then we'll proceed to discussion of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So I'll be talking about the DE1 throughout. It's the form in which I'd like the bill considered.
That's great. Any just quick thoughts about the DE1? That will be the bill, so we'll discuss it. But any other highlights of that?
If I were to do that, I'd be going through my whole discussion.
All right. Of the bill, So. Let's just adopt the DE1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion carries. We have House File 2677 as amended before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So I'm very happy to be bringing House File 2677 to this committee. It's an important bill that seeks to translate our statewide greenhouse gas emission targets into the transportation sector and recognizes that in order to reduce transportation emissions, land use is a, if not the, critical component. I'll also note that there's some amendment language that was not completed in time for this meeting. After this bill is heard in state and local gov, I believe it will be coming back here to be in our omnibus, so you'll see it again. But I may reference some of those changes as I talk. Now let me take you through the bill. Article 1, Section 1 is where MnDOT will be required to establish benchmarks for statewide greenhouse gas emissions reductions and allocate them across the transportation sector, with a special call out to the metropolitan area. Note that there's a reference to doing this in consultation with Met Council in line 1.9, that's being removed. In Article 1, Section 2 requires Met Council to embed climate components into comprehensive plan content so that they can be part of the next comprehensive plan cycle, again, with a special focus on land use. And a point here, in case there's any confusion, in the amended language, will make it clear that a standalone climate action plan is not required of cities. Article 2 requires that the Met Council conduct a land use study by June 30th, 2024, in time for the results to be included in the next round of comprehensive plans. The study is about how land use and transportation policies interact relative to environmental, greenhouse gas emissions, and equity goals. In Article 3 is where the greenhouse gas emission targets from Article 1, Section 1 are put into action for MnDOT. It requires MnDOT to consider these greenhouse gas emission targets as they undertake capacity expansion projects. If a project is going to result in increased emissions, MnDOT must find a way to offset the increase with projects that reduce emissions. So with that, I'm going to pass it over to my testifiers.
Thank you so much for that overview. And our first testifier will be Lou Miranda from the Edina City Planning Commission. Welcome to the Transportation Committee, Mr. Miranda. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Horstein and members of the committee. My name is Lou Miranda, and I'm a resident of Edina who's been appointed to our city's Planning Commission. My testimony in favor of this bill is due to my experience working on our climate action plan. I'm a transit advocate and was on the E-Line ABRT Community Advisory Committee, but you may find it surprising that a transit advocate like me drove here today. Why is that? Well, driving took less than 30 minutes while transit would take over three times as long. Is transit naturally inefficient? No. There are only two transit lines I need to take. 2 years from now, the E-Line ABRT will replace the 6-bus, and that alone will cut a third off my travel time to downtown Minneapolis, in part because Metro Transit is working with cities to give BRT lines priority at stoplights. The real laggard is the Green Line to St. Paul. In that corridor, state and local transportation agencies prioritize car travel, such as the traffic lights, thus slowing down transit unnecessarily. By realigning goals with climate change, transit will be prioritized, making it a no-brainer to take the climate-smart transportation route. This is a virtually zero-cost way to improve the lives of everyone who lives, works, or visits the Twin Cities. Cities want to do the right thing and adopt BMT goals, for example. But a year after approving our climate action plan, there are no concrete examples, much less ordinances, that will actually accomplish our transportation goals. There are a wide variety of changes that can be made to reduce VMT, such as banning right turn on red, removing one-way streets in urbanized areas, or creating protected bike lanes instead of paint in the form of sharrows or bike lanes. Cities and departments of transportation need both guidance and to be held accountable to the goals they claim to meet. A problem that we encounter when planning is not being fully apprised of what neighboring municipalities are doing. Cities get guidance from the Met Council on comprehensive planning, but while our city staff and consultants did an excellent job giving the Climate Action Plan work group background on what adjacent cities were doing, a big picture from the Met Council would make the process even smoother. For example, we have a bike and pedestrian plan that's mostly recreational in nature, and we'll need to update it for climate action, and making sure it connects to adjacent and regional bikeways makes for a much stronger plan. Finally, Edina already has been planning for and building affordable housing, and transit connections will make housing more affordable for people who won't have to purchase vehicles. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to hear testimony, and then if members have questions, we can bring up testifiers. And just, Mr. Miranda, I want to thank you for your work on the E-Line. I'm very familiar with that, and it runs through the area I represent, and you're absolutely right that that's going to be really helpful for mobility and equity throughout the region. So our next testifier is Sam Rockwell.
Chair Hornstein, Representative Kraft, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Sam Rockwell. I am Executive Director of Move Minnesota, and I also serve on MnDOT's Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council and also teach courses on both land use regulation and transportation at the University of Minnesota. As you know, transportation has persistently remained the highest greenhouse gas emitting sector in Minnesota. And transportation sustainability requires that Minnesota both electrify and reduce vehicle miles traveled, or VMT, by ensuring non-single occupancy vehicle travel works well, as we just heard, and by supporting walkable and vibrant community centers. We know these strategies are successful. For example, ridership on our bus rapid transit corridors jumped when those BRT lines opened, and that the ridership on those corridors has bounced back at more than double the pace of our entire transit network as we continue to recover from COVID. And we can see from St. Peter to Ely, places in between, that Minnesotans love to walk when our community centers make it possible and welcoming. So we need to employ these kinds of strategies, creating transportation options and strong community centers, to meet Minnesota's statutorily established greenhouse gas reduction goals and to meet MnDOT's VMT reduction target established just a couple months ago. Right now, these reduction targets, both VMT and greenhouse gas, are just goals. This bill before you today creates a structure for actually meeting those goals. In effect, this bill is about bringing accountability to promises that the state government has already made to all Minnesotans. The bill before you creates an obligation for MnDOT and Metropolitan Council to analyze and understand the climate impacts of agency plans and projects, and it ensures that planning for both transportation and land use will analyze vehicle miles traveled impacts. And this is key because we know that VMT is driven both by the design of our transportation infrastructure and the distribution of destinations in our communities. Also importantly, this bill requires MnDOT to analyze how projects affect the environment in areas of persistent poverty and historically damaged, disadvantaged communities. This analysis will help ensure that our transition to a clean economy is a just transition rather than a transition that entrenches disparities. The emissions and equity impacts of land use and transportation are intertwined, as are their joint impacts on access to opportunity, family and municipal pocketbooks, health, and more. This bill is critical because it does what no one agency can do on its own. It creates a pathway for joint transportation and land use planning and implementation in service of an environmentally and fiscally sustainable and equitable future for all Minnesotans, and in service to keeping the promises our state has already made to Minnesotans. I ask for your support for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Rockwell, and thank you for your work on this bill. Next testifier is Eric Lind. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Eric Lind. I work at the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies as a director of the Accessibility Observatory. That's kind of a mouthful, so I'm going to try it with a different AO, which is Access to Opportunity, as Sam just mentioned. The goal of our research is to make concrete this fundamental link between land use and transportation by measuring it with the most important outcome that we have in how people use the system, which is what you can do with it. So imagine setting off from this room after the hearing in search of lunch, let's say a fish sandwich. As you examine your mapping app or your mental map of St. Paul, you know you can reach some number of restaurants in 10 minutes on foot, maybe a few more if you hop on the light rail. And if you can park here and drive, maybe you can get to yet a few more places to eat. These fish sandwich opportunities you have are the combination of the transportation network and the land use around us. So, how far can you get in a certain amount of time? Plus, what do you get when you what do you find when you get there? So, where are the restaurants located? Are they clustered or dispersed? If there's only one, is there going to be a long line to get your lunch and so on? So, at the AO, what we do is this math for not just this room, but every block in the region, every block in the state, and actually the nation, and we measure the availability of jobs and other types of destinations that can be reached traveling from a given place at a given time for a given amount of time using a given mode. So a lot of choices that go into that, also a lot of math. I'm going to spare you the details of the math, but what results is actually a coherent picture, a literal map of what the transportation and land use system working together can offer people. And the key thing for this bill under discussion is that land use problems and transportation problems are really the same problem. Land use plans, transportation plans are really the same plans. There's no separating the concepts because people use the transportation system to access land use. So we at CTS and AO already share this perspective and, in fact, the data with our colleagues at MnDOT and the Met Council. And we'd be very interested to continue expanding this research and help meet the goals of the study proposed in this bill. So we can contribute by identifying places where land use changes can solve transportation problems and vice versa. Just thinking a well-placed fish sandwich restaurant could save you the drive. And that is what Access to Opportunity is all about. Thank you for your time listening.
Thank you for listening. Thank you. That was really excellent and helpful testimony. Last, we have Miguel and Morachek. Welcome back to the committee. I know we had you on Transit Equity Day, and welcome back to Minnesota.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. It's good to be back. Before we begin, I have slides. Is there a way for me to plug in, or should I distribute them to your members after the hearing?
We can, you can email them to our committee administrator, and then they can be distributed.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Could I have the email?
We'll get that after.
Yeah, we won't do it on the spot here.
Perfect. All right, well, I'm ready.
Welcome, and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Hornstein, Representative Kraft, and committee members, good morning. My name is Miguel Moravec, and I work for RMI. RMI is a nonprofit dedicated to finding climate solutions for all. And we co-lead the America Is All In Coalition, which is the largest grouping of subfederal actors ever dedicated to finding climate solutions. We actually hosted a webinar about climate smart policy 2 weeks ago, and many of our Minnesota members were in attendance, which is no surprise because Minnesota is already a national climate leader. Since the early 90s, the state adopted one of the first social costs of carbon, and in 2007, the state adopted one of the first climate goals with the Next Generation Energy Act. I think it's remarkable that when Minnesota realized it was not meeting its Next Generation Energy Act targets, it took action as recently as last month, passing the 100% power bill to align the power sector with the state targets. Now, Minnesota is considering tackling the largest sector of emissions in the state. The largest sector, even more than power, is transportation. As I've testified here before, it's going to take more than EVs, and it's going to take intentional application of bipartisan infrastructure law dollars to achieve the needed reductions. MnDOT says in its Pathways to Decarbonization report that there is no silver bullet and that a suite of policies must be considered. It says that in its own report. So, one policy that RMI has seen effective is the Colorado model of greenhouse gas planning at the project level, in the state. And what happened there is when Colorado realized that its state planning was exceeding the statutory obligation to reduce emissions, it prioritized new investments into transit and other multimodal solutions, creating 5 new bus rapid transit lanes, $900 million for walking and biking networks, and an additional suite of land use and transportation option reform. By prioritizing these investments, Colorado is now on track again to meet its transportation targets as required by state statute. Representative Petersburg, last time I was here, we discussed the cost-benefit analysis. I had the $40 billion of projected cost savings on the screen. I wanted to follow up with the full analysis. So $40 billion was the net projected savings. So that does include costs. The cost to actual state taxpayers was very limited, a few $100,000 for planning staff hours. And a few industries were impacted by the planning, but businesses and taxpayers gained a net $40 billion between 2020 and 2050, according to the state DOT's cost-benefit analysis. That's not advocates, that's the state DOT projecting that. Okay, so as most of you already know, MnDOT in its state transportation multimodal plan already has voluntary greenhouse gas targets. They are looking to achieve a complete carbon neutrality by 2050 in the transportation sector, but they state in the STMP that they need policy tools to get there. RMI used the federal formulas in the cost-benefit analysis from the Colorado application, and we started to calculate what would the benefit be in Minnesota, what would the benefit be if MnDOT hit its carbon neutral goals by 2050. Using the federal formulas and using the social cost of carbon that the power sector is required to meet as per the Minnesota legislature, so the social cost of carbon that this legislator has already approved, RMI projects that if MnDOT meets its carbon neutrality goal by 2050, there would be a reduction of $84 billion, $84 billion of cost savings from the social cost of carbon being achieved. Excuse me, carbon neutrality being achieved. So that is a big cost savings. That is not net. That is just the expected benefit. But a social cost of carbon includes a lot of things. So we also conducted an analysis just looking at the VMT target. So MnDOT already has a voluntary vehicle miles travel target of 7% reduction by 2050. If MnDOT was given the correct policy tools to achieve that VMT target, we could expect a number of cost savings, also in the order of tens of billions of dollars. Our analysis is preliminary, but we would expect by 2050, compared to MnDOT's baseline, $33 billion in savings from comprehensive vehicle fatality costs, $20 billion of savings from comprehensive injury costs, between $15 and $20 billion of savings from vehicle maintenance, depending on how much EVs are implemented in state, and another range of $14 to $28 billion in savings to Minnesota commuters based on fuel costs. These are obviously big numbers, tens of billions of dollars of savings directly to Minnesotans at the pump and in their wallet. And then you have the additional savings from the social cost of carbon. But I'll conclude my testimony by mentioning that, mentioning the opinion of Minnesotans on how they want to achieve their decarbonization. MnDOT conducted a survey in 2019 as part of this Pathways report, asking over 1,000 Minnesotans from both rural and urban areas what were their preferred strategies for achieving climate targets. And the top three strategies, as recorded by the survey, were walkable and bikeable communities, electric buses and trains, and improved public transport. So there is support already, more than EVs and other decarbonization strategies, by Minnesotans now to increase transportation options and achieve emissions reductions, as another survey question puts it, through requirements to include multimodal transportation and community design. Okay. That was certainly a lot, but I'll summarize my testimony now to conclude. Minnesota has already been a leader on climate action. To reach its climate goals, it's time to tackle emissions from transportation as well. Key strategies to reduce carbon pollution include considering emissions in state planning at the project level. And Minnesotans agree that investing in public transit and multimodal solutions is their preferred emissions slashing strategy, according to MnDOT. Our analysis of MnDOT's existing goals to decarbonize transportation will save tens of billions of dollars for Minnesotans by 2050 and create a cleaner, more affordable, and more equitable transportation system for all. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And is there anyone else in the public that wishes to testify? Yes, I was going to. Please come up, Ms. Nauman. I was, if you weren't here, I was going to reference the letter that you sent the committee. But it's good to see that you're here in person.
Thank you. Nice to see you again, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the executive director of Metro Cities, and Metro Cities, again, represents the collective interests of cities across the metropolitan region at the legislature executive branch and also the Metropolitan Council. I certainly want to, we have worked with Representative Kraft as a city official over the years, and I know this is a key issue of interest for him, and I just wanted to maybe touch base. I did provide a letter to the committee that really is not so much getting into the content of the proposed requirement, but sort of the process for how comp plan requirements are dealt with. And I know that the Metropolitan Council is also here and can answer any questions probably further than I can. But essentially, the comp plan requirements for cities in the metropolitan area are addressed and dealt with the Metropolitan Council under the broad statutory directive of the Land Use Planning Act, with cities being required to meet the requirements of plans that are consistent with regional systems and policies. And in the developing of those requirements, and this is maybe what I just want to touch on, that I think is harder to have a requirement like this in state law, is that it's harder to address local circumstances, needs, capacities, that the Metropolitan Council and local governments, city governments, do work very closely within collaboration as comp plan requirements are determined for each regional planning cycle. Metro City's policies are very explicit that the Metropolitan Council should work very closely with cities across the region in the setting of any comp plan requirement to address the individual needs of cities that do vary, the capacities vary, their ability to kind of do anything varies. I just wanted to reference, and I my understanding is that over 70 cities have provided some sort of plan for climate resilience, resiliency, in their last go-round of comprehensive plans. And so I think, again, it's not that cities are not interested in trying to meet goals. It's just where these requirements do get placed, and we do believe that they're best addressed between the region and local governments, especially as local governments are required to provide those plans to the Metropolitan Council for approval. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'd be happy to answer any questions. We certainly can look forward to working with the author to make sure that these processes are good ones.
So, thank you so much for your testimony. And is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Okay, members, now we'll move to an amendment, the A1 amendment. Is Representative Petersburg, that yours?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would move the A1 amendment. And this only specifically talks about the requirement in this bill that cities within the metropolitan area provide this information and their plan for it. And here's the reason why, and it's, this bill has a ton of mandates, a ton of requirements, requiring all sorts of different things to occur. And we heard in testimony that a lot of cities want to do this. And so by making this, basically what my amendment does is makes the plan, providing the plan as optional for those that want to do it. And that's the reason. If a lot of cities want to do it, they certainly can. I know that from my work with statistics and other things, you don't have to have 100% participation for the department and the council to know the direction in which things are going. And so I don't think it requires 100% participation. I do know that there's a lot of smaller cities with less dollars available that may take a little bit more dollars and input in order to be able to accomplish that to do it. So I think it's important for us to give them the option to say, you know, we just don't have the money to do that, and so we won't participate at this particular one. We talk about, one testifier talked about transportation options, and well, this is just an option that's given to the particular cities that maybe don't have to do this. Again, bottom line, though, for me is that this is an opportunity where we should try to eliminate some of the mandates rather than always mandating a lot of things to it. So that's the purpose of this bill. And Mr. Chair, I would like to be on record of giving this option to the cities rather than making it. So I will request a roll call on it as well.
Roll call has been requested. We will have a roll call. I'll defer to the author to respond. And we'll have some committee discussion as well.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg. So I appreciate the amendment. I may even ask if you would consider withdrawing it with my commitment that the plan is that we will make it clear that no standalone climate action plan will be required in the bill. But I just think that it will be in a different that will be in a different place in it in the amendment language that I'll be doing.
Mr. Chair, if he's willing to work with me between now and the next stop, I will withdraw the amendment.
Okay.
Yep.
The amendment has been withdrawn, and I appreciate your willingness to work with Representative Petersburg in addressing his concerns. So we have a few members that would like to speak, Representative Olson and then Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Murphy.
To the author, just a real quick question. So the way I'm kind of reading it, and I from what the conversation has been had, you when you're a city within the 7-county metropolitan area, you provide a 10-year plan to the Met Council, and then from this bill, that's going to just require an extra report. Every 10 years, we have to provide an extra report within that packet that says, here's our climate action plan that goes along with everything else. Am I understanding that correctly?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson. So the the comprehensive plans actually look out more than 10 years. They're required to be updated every 10 years, but they generally look out, I think, about 20 years. The next round will look out to 2050. So what we're talking about here is embedding some of this work within the comprehensive planning process, not requiring a standalone climate action plan.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then just one real quick question. I was looking, and I don't know, I couldn't find the answer. Do you have any information on how long it takes to create an actual legitimate climate action plan, how much it would cost a city to do that? You know, you could put together three pieces of paper and be like, hey, this is our climate action plan. But like, legitimately, we did a great job. We're trying to work hard for the climate and making sure that this all makes sense. Do you have an idea of the resources that will need to be invested in order to make that happen?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson. So again, we're not requiring a standalone climate action plan. I do know the range of costs on climate action plans can be from, you know, low thousands of dollars, up to, you know, very extensive ones. But we're not requiring that. What we want to do is to build it into the comprehensive planning process, which I think is the most cost-effective approach to do that.
Representative Olson.
Perfect. Thank you. And I would agree that if you're going to require a climate action plan, putting it within the, you know, we're working on this whole plan together. I was just curious because I couldn't find the answer. So, you know, obviously this is not, I don't represent these counties and you do. So I'm sure you know what's best for your county.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Next on the list is Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question and then a follow-up. In your comments, I don't see it in the bill, but in your comments you mentioned that when MnDOT does a project, they calculate the emissions, and then if it's a project that has greater emissions, they had to find an offsetting one. I thought I heard you say something like that, but I don't see it in the bill, so I'm
wondering if you clarify. That is in...
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative West, that is in Article 3, starting in around lines 4.4 in the DE.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, okay, I did hear correctly. That is a massive concern for me because Highway 65 is a big deal in my district. It's what I've been talking about my entire time in the legislature. And building a road compared to, say, a mass transit opportunity is generally always going to be more emissions in comparison. So when we're dealing with limited resources and Highway 65 needs $130 million, it's going to be really tough if there's another thing to compete with. And my concern with this whole bill is it moves us in a way that we're dictating to people what they want rather than allowing people to have the freedom to choose the communities they desire. For example, so we have, it would prioritize transit over Highway 65 and potentially delay the implementation of that. But it also, density is another thing that's heavily pushed in most climate plans because density helps lower emissions. But not everybody wants to live in a dense community. Door knocking and Blaine, the two issues, Highway 65, and they don't want any more apartment buildings. In fact, one of the last apartment buildings considered in Blaine, there was public outcry, and then they didn't approve the project for a $100 million apartment building. So some people want to choose the communities they're in, and by making cities do this, we're forcing the cities not to represent their constituents. And I don't think that's very American. We should be supporting people's freedom to choose and letting technology, which has been the main driver of lowering climate change and lowering our emissions, because when we try and offset it in our state, it generally will go somewhere else. For example, building EVs, batteries, all this super copper-intensive work, but we don't want to mine copper in Minnesota efficiently, so then we'll probably buy that copper from China. And climate change is a global issue. So looking at this, I don't think it does any good because it's a global issue, and it incentivizes density and apartments, which my community doesn't want, And most importantly is Highway 65, is I don't like the idea of prioritize, like having to fund two projects and then, well, I guess we can't do Highway 65 because it'll increase emissions, so we're going to put more money into a light rail train elsewhere. So that's my big concern with this bill.
Thank you, Representative West. Representative Fidella.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question and a couple of follow-ups. So question for the author. I see references in the bill to mining and manufacturing and some things outside the scope of transportation. Does this bill have stops in committees that are pertinent to those areas?
Representative Kraft.
excuse me, Mr. Chair. Representative Hudella, you said reference to mining?
Representative Hudella.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I underlined it in here. It's in Article 3, 4.14 through 4.16, and it's just driving research and stages of production for looks like raw materials, including but not limited to mining, manufacturing. There's a couple of references in those lines.
Yeah. Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Hudella. So that's about embodied carbon emissions. So it's actually just asking that as we think about reducing emissions, we're thinking about not just the emissions that are generated from an act, but what is used to create a product or along those lines. So what, you know, how much goes into building a road kind of a thing or building a train, right? How much goes into the creation of those things? You're having a larger picture.
Representative Fidella.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just move on to a couple comments. So I am glad to hear there's a willingness not to mandate this on the cities. I think just massive burden of scope for cities. We've got a letter from the Metro cities saying they don't want it. I do have a concern just with the massive scope of this for MnDOT and Met Council that we're not hearing from those commissioners here and from the higher levels of the folks in those departments to find out where their support is at and maybe some questions on their planning for implementation and really for me a bigger concern with Met Council. Yesterday we were talking about completely overhauling that department. In my opinion, they can't manage a McDonald's right now and we're going to throw this massive burden of additional reporting and oversight for cities onto them. I'd really love to have them in here to answer some questions on it. So I would encourage as it comes back for the omnibus hearing in this committee that we get some higher level representation from both MnDOT and Met Council here so that we can ask some questions to those folks as well. Thank you.
Members, so we have almost everybody on the committee on the list, so, and we have about 20 minutes. So you have the record, Representative Kraft, for most committee interest for a bill. Representative Murphy, so if people could keep their questions short and your response crisp as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought you were eliminating me from the list there for a minute.
No. You are always on the list.
Thank you. I have a few questions for actually Mr. Is it Morissette? Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, so a few questions for you.
Miguel.
Thank
Welcome
you, Miguel.
Back.
You mentioned that Minnesota is the leader, and then you reference Colorado quite often. I was wondering if you could tell us what the target is for temperature for successful climate change.
Climate change mitigation, I think.
Let's say it about the year 2100.
Sure. So generally, from the Paris Climate Agreement, which the United States is a member of, we're aiming for a 1.5 degree Celsius increase, and we'd consider that a successful mitigation.
The American experiment talks about a change in temperature of 0.019 centigrade by the year 2100. So that's what their number is. So there's a little difference in numbers, but neither one are very big. Can you tell me the level of Mr. Chair. Can you tell me the level of carbon in the air today?
Sure. From my latest general understanding, I believe we're around 419 parts per million, although I could double check that for you, Representative.
Mr. Chair? Yeah, American Experiment says it's 416, so very close. Do you know what the level of the level of carbon in the air that stops photosynthesis is?
I do not, Representative.
It's 189 parts per million of carbon in the air. Do you know how much carbon it takes for soybeans to grow? What's the optimum level?
I do not, Representative.
Okay, so we'll have one more question here in our 20 questions regimen. Representative Kraft, did you want to respond? I'll allow you one more question, Representative Murphy, but please respond.
Let's hear the last question, and then I'd like to respond.
I'll just finish up without the questions. Yeah. Actually, for soybeans to grow, this is the current top level. Anything we start doing now starts taking away from the yield of soybeans. Corn is actually at a net negative. So corn, we have room, actually, with carbon. It'll do more good to plant corn. And so my thought here is that we have China that's adding all the time to our world climate problem. And yet we're estimating that we're going to change the temperature by what we do here, by 1.5 or 0.019. Is there anything to know for the taxpayers to know that we've accomplished that? We're on task?
Representative Kraft.
Chair Hornstein, Representative Murphy. It's going to be hard to be quick, but if we have the level of carbon in our atmosphere, and as it goes up, we will have increased droughts and floods, which will be horrible for growing corn and soybeans, regardless of what they can do. If you're talking about China, this is a collective problem. What we can do here is important, and by the way, what you also heard from Mr. Morchek was that the things that we can do will have tremendous savings for taxpayers over time, so as well as improve our quality of life. So there's a lot of benefits and things here, so I think that's all I'll say.
Thank you for your questions.
May I respond as well?
Okay. Members, I will take one quick question, one quick response, and then for everyone to participate, we really need to be aware of that. Representative Murphy.
I'm just going to say at the final part that this is a really important part. There's the members on both sides. To rush this through, I think, this is the key part of what we're talking about. And, you know, as far as the way we're going to do it, I would like to know what it's going to show us at the end of the day, how we benefited. And as far as the Met Council goes, they had a huge black eye. I was at the audit yesterday. They have a huge black eye. So having them in charge of running it is a problem. So that's all I've got.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And I would just say we've set aside an hour, so I don't think we're necessarily rushing this through. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question revolves around, first, the first two articles tend to deal more with metropolitan area. Article 3 represents statewide policies, and I have concerns, and the question I'll ask at the very end. We talked a lot about in testimony about bikeable and walkable communities, and about how disbursement of opportunities and how land use makes a big difference. The problem with that theory is that works only at a certain density level. Greater Minnesota, which is the bulk of the geographical area of the state, has areas in which there may be a town in which there's no grocery store at all. And so to use the same parameters is difficult. My question, I guess, is in regards to the statewide expansion projects, and this is probably to the author of the bill, I don't see that there's any variance or opportunities to make discretionary decisions on what we do in those particular areas, because it's going to be different. And so to the author, are you anticipating that they will have some leeway in order to make those changes, or does it have to be one size fits all?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, it is not intended to be one size fits all. In the allocation of targets, greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets, I would expect that they would be different depending on which region of the state they're in. To acknowledge that in some places you can do more density, and in others there may be different tools that are needed to reduce emissions, like maybe invest more in EV chargers or in certain areas. So.
quick follow-up, Representative Peters?
Well, I'll be looking forward to that discussion because I didn't see where that is allowed to the Transportation Department.
I would say in Article 1, Subdivision 3, B.3, that's where it's intended to be, and we can improve the language there to address that better.
Yeah, I think we need to. Yeah.
Thank you. And then just before I call on our next two members, Representative Elkins and Representative Sensenmuir, I did want to acknowledge both Representative Sensenmuir and Representative Elkins. A big, important bill like this is a team effort, and both of them have been involved and engaged in this, and I wanted to thank both of you for your input. Representative Elkins and then Representative Sensenmuir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my personal first engagement with the Metropolitan Council was when I was appointed a member of a citizen-at-large member of its Transportation Advisory Committee. And during that period, there was a staffer at the Met Council named Karen Lyons, who was the first one to introduce me to the concept of transit-oriented development and the importance of coordinating transportation and land use policy. And that just wasn't being done at all at the Met Council during that era. I remember making a remark to a guy named Eli Cooper, who was the director of economic development at the time, that Eli, I said, it's like when cities submit their comprehensive plans, somebody at the front desk breaks the spine, sends each of the chapters off to the respective department at the Met Council, and then at the end of the process, nobody puts them back together again. So when I was appointed by Governor Dayton to the Met Council itself in 2011, one of the first things that I pressed for was a greater integration among the different system plans that the Met Council produces to guide cities and counties in the region and their own planning. So for the first time, for example, we rewrote the regional blueprint, which is the land use plan, and the transportation policy plan, which is the transportation plan. And we did them in parallel and, overlapping so that in particular in the transportation plan for the first time, there were sections that described transit-oriented development and provided, some cases requirements and goals for cities to make in that round of comprehensive plans, which was applicable for 2020 to 2040, in those comprehensive plans. And we've seen that reflected in many of the city and county transportation plans for that era. So this is the what Representative Kraft is proposing here is just the next logical step in that progression of, greater integration between the transportation and land use plans. And it's at the perfect time as well, because we're now in the process, in the decennial planning process, where the Met Council will be rewriting the next iteration of those plans, the ones that will replace the ones that my Met Council did in the early 2010s. It's the next logical progression, and this is the time to do it, because as this Met Council rewrites those plans to provide the guidance to those cities, we'll get the next iteration of better integration between transportation and land use planning. So to answer another question that had been posed, the Met Council has historically, as smaller cities develop their comprehensive plan, are providing staff assistance to the counties or cities in preparing the plans. And I expect that as a result of this bill, the Met Council staff will continue to do that and will probably require a little bit more staff assistance to incorporate this into the plans, but it's well worthwhile.
Thank you so much for that historical context. Very important. Representative Sensenmuir.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing this important bill and this important conversation. I want to start off, I just have a couple comments. I think commenting on, how this might affect greater Minnesota. I want to say as a Metro member, as someone who's lived in an urban area my whole life, I've really appreciated the conversations on this committee. I feel like I've learned a lot from folks across the aisle just about, some of the things that we're pushing for, really how they're not possible in your communities, right? And like I admit that I come into that with a lot of ignorance, and so I've appreciated hearing from you and hearing from your perspective, and so I want to focus mostly on how this can impact the metro, but you know, I'm also sitting on the education committee, and we earlier this year approved for some funding, you know, some additional funding for transportation for school buses. And, you know, hearing about students that have to travel an hour and a half to get to school, I mean, that's the reality, but I do think that there's some room for rethinking that, right? Because when I hear that, that's the reality right now. Kids need to get to school. I'm absolutely, you know, want to give them the funding to do so, but I also think, like, in a quality of life perspective, like, I don't want kids sitting on a school bus for 3 hours from a carbon emissions perspective. Like, that's not great. So I do wonder if, you know, if there's something we can do there to link transit and land use better in rural Minnesota. But, you know, focusing on the metro, you know, Representative West, I appreciate your comments. And I would say, even though I represent, you know, a district that's probably more amenable to density and transportation, I hear the same concerns, right? I hear so much in the conversation, I think, from both sides of the aisle. We just hear, like, a lot of loss and fear when we talk about how our communities may change, how our communities may need to change because of climate change. And, you know, I think what I hear a lot from my constituents is the fear of density and transit, or really transit without any change to our land use policies, right? So I hear people say, right now I can get to work in, you know, 10 minutes. What do you want me to walk an hour to work, right? Or right now I can get to the grocery store in 5 minutes, or I can get to my fish sandwich in 2 minutes, right? And now you're going to make me, you know, sit on the train for 30 minutes. And so I appreciate this, that it's really saying we have to link the land use with the transit. That is the only way that we are both going to meet our goals around emissions and climate, but we're also going to, like, improve quality of life. And, you know, I've lived in cities where maybe it wasn't a fish sandwich, but you could walk from your job within, you know, 5 minutes and get a slice of pizza or get lunch easily. And I had a higher quality of life. I think, you know, I was in better shape because I was walking more. I spent less time in my car, which for me, like, was a better mental health thing. And so, you know, on the other side of this, I think we have to talk about all the things that we will gain, all of the benefits from doing better planning. You know, this is planning that we already do. This is just making sure that we're making decisions that are informed by the reality of our climate, you know. And I think, just talking about the district I represent, you know, I hear people say, like, I live in Minneapolis because I want a place that I can, a city, but I also want to be able to get in my car and go anywhere in 10 minutes. And, you know, and you could say, if you don't want that and you want some place with better public transportation, then move to New York or move to Chicago. But, I mean, I think the reality is, like, Minneapolis will have to change. The science shows us that we are going to have to make different decisions because of climate. It's not a choice anymore whether or not you want that kind of transportation, you want that kind of density, you want that kind of change in our land use. And so I think we need to absolutely be both giving cities and regions guidance on how to do that, and also holding them accountable to making sure they do that. So thank you.
Thank you. Very well said. I'm not going to ask you to respond to these, maybe just at the end in your closing comments. So we have Representative Cagle, Representative Norris, and then we'll wrap up. We, by the way, a roll call has been requested by Representative Petersburg, so just wanted to give members a heads up on that. Representative Norris. Oh, sorry, Representative Cagle, then Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kraft, thank you for bringing this forward. You know, we see climate change is happening, and we really should be doing everything we can to mitigate it and adapt it. And I really adapt to it. And so I really see this kind of as, like, the group project. And, you know, just because China and Russia aren't going to do it doesn't mean that I want to get an F, you know, and I'm still going to get an A. I don't see them as our moral compass. And so I really think that, you know, this is a group project, and some of us might have to lift a little heavier weight. And when kind of going back to Representative West's Highway 65, I see this as a perfect example of how this could work. This was a study that was community driven, that had tons of input from the community across the sector. The plans that I've seen, it is a multimodal plan that does not expand our current right of way, takes into account pedestrians bike and transit into account. So, like,
I guess I'm just not quite sure. We're not taking it and turning it into a freeway. We're thinking about our communities differently, and that is exactly what we did with the Highway 65 Pell study. And so we're not expanding. We're reducing the time we're sitting on that road, which has an impact on our carbon emissions, also has an impact on our quality of life because we're not sitting on that stupid road for, you know, an hour. And we're thinking about how are we going to be crossing Highway 65, not just getting north-south, but east-west without, you know, without holding up traffic and making sure that we're progressing up the road. And so I just, like, I guess I just don't understand the opposition, and I really want to thank you for taking this on. Thank you, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Representative Norris, Representative Brand, and then we'll wrap up.
Thanks, Chair Hornstein. And as you may have guessed, I wanted to get in on the Highway 65 party too. And Representative Cagle, I think, said a lot of what I was planning to say. But I wanted to maybe, and I know we're short on time, but I was hoping we could at least just get the author on the record to, you know, Representative West raised some concerns. And, you know, I guess reading this bill, I'm not sure it's as dire for Highway 65 as he painted, but I wanted to give the author an opportunity to kind of go on the record and clarify that.
I think what we'll do is, please note that, because we're going to give you the last word here. I thought Representative Cagle also addressed that too, but the author can as well. So Representative Brand, and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing I would add to this conversation is where I represent the St. Peter Mankato area. St. Peter is becoming a green step city. This is part of the conversation that they are doing. The skies aren't falling and the sun still rises every morning. In Mankato, they have a citywide greenhouse gas inventory. They are a green step city. They continue to look at this. The sky is not falling. The sun still comes up. MSU Mankato is even doing this as well. And so I think when we're talking about the largest communities in the entire state of Minnesota and ensuring that the land use policies are addressing climate action planning, we ought to do this as a legislature.
Thank you very much. And just before I call on you, I just wanted to thank you, Representative Kraft. This is a really, I think you've hit the high points of policies that I think we've wanted to implement for many, many years. I hearken back to the study that the Center for Transportation Studies did and Humphrey back in 2008, 2009 at the request of Speaker Hortman. And that study concluded, she wasn't Speaker at that time, but Representative Hortman, and that study concluded that addressing the issues of land use in transportation was the number one way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in transportation. And I think we've lagged behind. You know, we've implemented some important transit policies and electrification and clean cars, all significant, very important. But I feel that we've sort of left this one behind, and now we're catching up with your bill. So I want to thank you and express my strong support and appreciation. Last word goes to the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank everyone on the committee for your comments and questions and challenges. They've all been very helpful. A few things I want to address. The Met Council piece, I also attended the presentation the other day about the Southwest, and I was also deeply disturbed by it, and we need to address it. That said, the Met Council has been managing the comprehensive plan process, and I think doing so effectively. So I have confidence that this, the things we're asking are something within their wheelhouse to do. On Highway 65, I think Representative Cagle, you know, said it very well. You have to look at the totality of things. My understanding, too, it's going to reduce a lot of traffic and stop and go. By the way, stopped cars, idling are huge emission generators. So, and even so, this is not saying that, boy, if we need a capacity expansion project somewhere, that we shouldn't do it. There are reasons to do those things. But in the broad scope, we have to be thinking how we reduce our emissions. Okay, so not applied to any specific one. And I will say, from everything I've heard about Highway 65, I am supportive of the things that you need to do, okay? Now, there was also a comment made about forcing people to do things a certain way. I am not for forcing people, especially when we force people abruptly. Well, you have to change, you have to do something right now differently. I will say one of the big challenges we are going to face in the future is that the earth is going to start forcing us to do things abruptly with droughts and wildfires and flooding. Okay, so part of this is to address that as well. The other thing I will say is another thing I've heard in greater Minnesota is concerns about maybe sometimes solar chewing up farmland. Another thing I would say is, what if housing all of a sudden begins to chew up lots of prime farmland, right? I think it is our job as government to make sure we put the proper incentives in place so that we can live in harmony with our environment and live in harmony together. And what this is intending to do is to do that, is to think long-term, is to not to force any immediate changes, but that we can put the right incentives in place so that we can develop intelligently in balance and in harmony with our the habitat that sustains us. With that said, this is an important bill. I would appreciate everyone's support in moving on and then coming back. As all said, land use is absolutely critical to both hitting our emission targets and to our quality of life going forward.
Thank you so much. I will renew my motion that House File 2677 as amended be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll on the bill.
Hornstein.
Yes.
Hornstein, yes. Habke excused. Petersburg.
No.
Petersburg, no. Brand.
Yes.
Brand, yes. Elkins.
Elkins, yes.
Elkins, yes. Hudela.
No.
Hudela, no. Cagle.
Yes.
Cagle, yes. Kraft.
Yes.
Kraft, yes. Murphy.
No.
Murphy, no. Nelson.
Yes.
Nelson, yes. Norris.
Yes.
Norris, yes. Olson.
Pass.
Olson, pass. Sensormira.
Yes.
Sensormira, yes. West.
No.
West, no. Olson?
Pass.
Pass.
And Mr. Chair, we have 8 ayes and 4 nays.
There being 8 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails. You're on your way to state and local government finance and policy. And with that, members, I wish you a very happy St. Patrick's Day, a good weekend, and we'll be back at our usual meeting room in the Capitol at 8:30 on Tuesday. We are adjourned.